18 is that DNA sort of on that chromosome. And you're seeing it wrapped around these histones. And once that DNA is wrapped and closed tight, information can't get to it, and it silences those genes. Where you're seeing that little purple or pink area there, that's areas of the DNA that are actually open to communicate with the cell. And the way your genes get turned on and off is there are things called transcription factors. Those could be hormones, they could be neurochemicals, they could be a variety of things that come and attach themselves to the promoter, to promote, the promoter region of that DNA. And when they do, they trigger the DNA to transcribe the information it has for a protein. Your DNA is just a library of how to make proteins. When it gets transcribed, it sends a little script out there called messenger RNA to go out to your protein factories in your cell, and we need this protein, build it this way. Does that make sense? Okay. So if you close that up and you can't get to it, then you can't make that protein. Now, this is critically important for us functioning normally. You know that every single cell in your body has exactly the same DNA, right? Which is why you can take a scraping from your cheek and send it off to 23andMe or whatever you're doing and find out about your DNA. That might be DNA that is important or genes that are important for your liver cells, but you don't have to go in and take a piece of your liver out and send it because every cell in your body has the same DNA. But if every cell in your body was making the same proteins and doing it in response to the same signals, you would be what? You would be a single-celled organism, and we're not. So a good portion of what happens from conception to birth, as we go from being a single-celled organism into being this multi-differentiated cells, is that the DNA in your different kinds of cells are being regulated. They're being silenced, they're being wrapped up, they're being opened up so that they produce the protein appropriate for that cell. All of that is, of course, absolutely fabulous. But this process continues after birth. And that has been the profound realization of the last 10 years. Started out in cancer biology because the cancer biologists were trying to figure out why do cells go crazy and not do what they're supposed to, and that has to do with some of this in, you know, response to toxins and other things that you might ingest. Okay, but it's also happening in response to psychosocial experience. And that is very much part of what we're understanding is the story now of how our experiences shape our body and brain to function in the environments that we get born into. Okay, nature doesn't hate us. These processes adapt us. But as you get adapted to one kind of environment, it can preclude you being able to work in other kinds of environments. And that's very much what we're talking about today. So let me give you a sense of how profound this is, because this really is totally cool Discovery Channel kind of stuff. What you see, that's chromosome 17. And on the left, we see it from three-year-old identical twins, and on the right, from 50-year-old identical twins. And what they've done is they color-coded this. So if it's yellow, then it means that the, oh, you know what? I messed myself up. I need to go back here. How do you close this up? One of the more permanent ways is to add a methyl mark to that, to the DNA, and then it gets wrapped up. So we assess, we measure often how much methylation has occurred, and it tells us whether the opening up or the closing is similar in two different cells. Okay, so now back here. The yellow, the methylation is identical in the two twins. But if you see green or red, it means it's different. And at three, you can see these guys have been growing up in the same environment, eating the same food, et cetera, et cetera. And even so, there's still a little green there. Not all of their cells are being regulated the same way on that chromosome. By 50, these identical twins, their genes are being regulated very differently because they have lived in different worlds and eaten different foods and so on since they left home, married different people, had different experiences. So this is happening throughout our lives, and it's why identical genes in and of themselves don't tell us the whole story of development. Okay, they're very important, but they don't tell the whole story. So now, we know this can happen with experience. I'm going to tell you about two studies, one with monkeys and one with children. The animal studies are critically important for our understanding of cause and effect. because you cannot randomly assign children to different kinds of rearing environments, but you can do that with animals. And in this study, these monkeys were either raised with their mothers or were randomly assigned to be raised, have their mothers taken away, and they're only raised with other monkeys. Okay. In the other experiment I'm going to tell you, these are children and their mothers in Child Protective Service, and they've been randomly assigned to two different interventions, one of which has known to be very powerful and to work well in helping get the family back on track. So let me show you the first results of the first study. So here what you're seeing is called a heat map. And in this one, if it's redder, it's more methylated, more wrapped up. And if it's greener, it's more open. All along the side, there are over 1,300 genes listed, all the way up and down there. And each line across is a monkey. And on the left-hand side, they're the mother-reared monkeys. And on the right-hand side, they're the peer-reared monkeys. The point here is, and this is pieces, slices out of the prefrontal cortex, so this is brain data. Within a few months of birth, growing up in these very different circumstances, the genes in their brains are being differentially regulated. Okay? And in a way that's relatively permanent throughout their lives and will influence the way those nerves act. Is that making sense? It's pretty profound. Is it clear? Because this is a really, did I do it okay? Good.
Representative Cortese-Witun.
Thank you. Yes. Can you repeat which side is which, the monkeys?
And Dr. Gunner.
It almost doesn't, I got to remember how to do this. Yes, Representative Carly and Chair Pinto. It almost doesn't matter because nature, the left side is actually the mother-reared and the right side is the peer-reared. The point is the genes are being differentially regulated. So those monkeys are being adapted to live in the context that they grew up in. Presumably, through evolution, these adaptations are helping us to survive to reproduce for the next generation. They may not be helping us survive to become great citizens of the monkey world in this case. Okay, but there's adaptation.
Thank you.
Okay, and they look very different. And my friend Steve Sumi, whose data this is, calls it his Christmas cards because they sort of look like a Christmas wrapping. Okay, this is a study with kids. Now, challenging again because I can't do the pointer. But if you, the ABC guys are the attachment and biobehavioral catch-up. These moms are being trained in what we will come to call serve and return kind of interactions with their children. And on the right, DEF is just they're being trained in information about child development. If we knew more about child development, we'd do better by kids. This is cells from the mouth, so there's a proof of concept. We're not taking them out of the brain, heavens, no. And if you look at the DEF side, you have pre and post. Blue is less methylated, red is more methylated, and what you should notice is there's not much change, right? I mean, the intervention didn't do much to methylation. On the left side, though, the ABC, the pre and the post, whatever is going on in that intervention has organized very consistent patterns of methylation across those kids. And it's a 10-week intervention. So experience powerfully shapes us at the genomic level. That's the point. Now, you all have probably heard, of course, that experience also helps us wire up the brain. This is the old idea of use it or lose it. Okay? Basically, what nature has is this really cool process going on. What you're seeing there are neurons. These happen to be taken from the prefrontal cortex of babies who have died. And that's at birth. And those neurons are not connected up with each other. In order for neurons to send signals, they have to connect with each other. They have to form circuits. Then genetically, at a certain point in development, we get this overproliferation of connections. Suddenly, all these neurons are talking to all these other neurons. This is not really efficient, okay? But it lays down the possibility that now all you have to do is send consistent messages across neurons, neurons that fire together, wire together, and as you get that, then the ones that are sending consistent messages remain, those connections, and the other ones get pruned away. And now you have an efficiently organized brain to process the information that the brain has been thinking about during that time. Our brains become what our brains spend time thinking about. We become really good at what we're thinking about and doing every day. And if that is learning how to avoid the police, we get really better at that. So if it's learning how to avoid your abusive dad, you get good at that. You're survive, but you may not be good at other things that you haven't been spending time thinking about because you've had to think about this. Does that make sense? Okay.
Dr. Gunner, could you just talk about the parenthetical there? Because that kind of blew my mind when I first heard it about the 700 synapses per second. Just the...
Yeah. So when our brains go, poof, let's all connect, that's when all those synapses get formed. Now the big important job is pruning them back. Okay, so yes, that's often used as, wow, we have to do something. And it's really, wow, now the brain is set up so that what we're doing will shape the pathways that are there and prune the right things. We do know when there is high levels of stress, and we'll get to stress later, that more connections go away than should. Okay. But more often than not, what we're doing is adapting the brain to the context it's growing up in, and we want that context to support the kind of activity that we want our citizens to engage in as adults to support a successful society.
And I think that Representative Katiza Batun has a question.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Gunner, point of clarification, on the right-hand side there, the 14-year post-pruning, would that be considered methylated, as you were discussing in the other cells, or is it something completely
terminology? A related process, mm-hmm. which I will get to next.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, but methylation is playing a role in this. We're learning how to connect up all the dots now. Okay, so you saw this is birth to 14. This process begins from the back of the brain forward, as what we're doing is setting up the neural circuitry for vision and hearing and the coordination of movement with that, and then the areas of the brain that are involved in language and other kinds of processing are getting set up. And then you have the higher cognition getting going, which starts in the first year but extends well into adolescence. And then after everything, when things are set up, you wrap that nice myelin around it so it's efficient, and brain development is not over until 25, okay? But the foundation is set in this early first 2-3 years of life, and that foundation is critically important for everything that's going to come after. And to help explain some of that, I need to talk about something called sensitive periods. Sensitive periods in development are when the experiences you have are particularly useful in setting up a particular capacity. So if we think of these neuronal circuits as creating tools to process information, tools in the way that you'll process vision, tools in the way that you will hear language coming in. Little babies can understand the vowels and consonants in every language in the world. By the time they're 9 months, they can't hear certain things they haven't been hearing, and they get really good at hearing the sounds that are part of their own language. That's a tool that helps them really learn their own language, right? We have that also for how we process faces. Little babies are really good at telling monkeys apart. By the time they're 9 months, a monkey's a monkey, unless they've been growing up with them, and they get really good at telling people apart. So a part of this whole process is being able to, during sensitive periods, wire up the regions of our brain that are necessary to process the information that we will need in order to become really effective adults. Make sense? And then when that period closes, it's hard to go back and redo that. Okay, and we now are beginning to understand the biology, the actual physical process that's going on, and it's pretty cool. And so what we are understanding now is that, let's say what you've got on the left is a neuron, a GABAergic neuron, and it's still in a very plastic, changeable state. But it's not really reacting all that much to its environment. Its energy, you know, its excitation and inhibition balance is just, it's not working. And then there's chemistry that happens. And it says, oh, now it's time for you to really process and get that tool, whatever tool of the mind you're building, get it organized. And for a period of time, the information that comes in is really going to help it orchestrate its connections, et cetera. Now, you've got to ask, why doesn't the brain stay constantly like that? Well, I think about it as like if you need to have a trowel in order to dig in your garden. Someone has taken that metal, they've heated it up, they've fashioned it into a trowel, and then they've done something so that it hardens. And now you can't do anything with it except use it as a trowel, right? But if you left it all soft and malleable, you'd stick it in your garden and it wouldn't work. So nature has spent a lot of time opening up, creating the tool, and then closing it down so you can't change it very well. And the way we know it closes it down now is to put basically a hairnet on it. They're called perineuronal nets. That means around the neuron. And they are actually sort of sugar nets that wrap around that neuron and say, okay, you're done now, so you're stabilized. You can change a bit, but you're not going to change like you were before. It's really like a hairnet on those neuronal circuits. And that's a lot of what's happening in those first few years. The basic tools are getting set up, the hairnet's going around it, and now the kid has the tools to move on. But they're going to move on and process the world according to the way the tools got set up for them at that time in relation to the experience that's coming in. Make sense? Okay. So, now I hope I've convinced you experience matters to little babies, and I have to then talk about the fact that I have no idea what nature was thinking. Experience matters so much to us. We don't do much by instinct, and yet we are born among the most helpless organisms on the planet. Left to our own devices, there's no way we can provide the stimulation our brains need to get set up. No way. Those of you who have been recently looking at little babies, you know they can't hold their heads up. They can't. Oh, my grandchild, Harper's, just got his fist to his mouth and figured out how to do that. He is a happy camper. But before that, he couldn't do that. You can't provide that stimulation. And yet, we develop one of the most sophisticated brains, in fact, the most sophisticated brain on the planet. So you have to ask how that happens and why it happens. And it happens because brains evolved, our brain evolved, to develop in the context of relationships. Relationships with parents, but also with siblings, relationships with grandparents and granddaddies, and relationships with brothers and sisters. Relationships are the context of human brain development. And we're beginning to understand what the grist of those relationships, why they work so well when they do work, to help that brain develop. And we talk about it as sensitive and responsive interaction, or you can call it serve and return, or call and response. What happens is babies, or their brains organize a signal and they emit a sound, or they emit a movement, or they look at you. That's the serve. And when the people in their environment respond with an appropriate rewarding response, those neural circuits are confirmed. They say, oh, that one worked. And if that keeps happening, that neuronal circuit gets nicely built, and then you have a nice tool for interaction, a tool for processing the environment, a tool for hearing what's going on. The core of serve and return provides interesting things to think about and interesting things to do. Babies are the most helpless creatures on the planet, and they run entire households of many adults. I mean, we've just had a grandbaby, and I know that the entire household affects several households. We're all organized around that baby for a while, and keeping that baby a happy camper, and that is that baby, Patrick. Communication-rich environment, which for our species is terribly important because so much of those serves and returns are the baby making a sound and the adults or the other people coming back with, yes, baby, aren't you cute? You're so sweet. And warm, not harsh or frightening interactions. So serve and return supportive interactions are characterized by interesting things to do, creating a communication-rich environment, and a warm, supportive, not harsh and frightening environment. And we know that has big effects on brain development. This is a study by Joan Luby, where the kids were 3 years of age when they assessed the quality of serve and return in the children's environment, and they imaged the brains and looked at brain volume at 8 years of age. And the more serve and return at 3, the better the brain volume at 8. Now, they probably also had good serve and return from birth to 3 and then after, right? And the other thing they looked at, though, was how much stress the family was under. Because there is nothing that will deep six good serve and return interaction in families than intense stress on the parents, which then get to the kid. And in fact, the amount of family stress exposure at three was associated with worse or small, less volume in brain development at age eight. And that is my segue to move from stimulation to stress, which is my area. I've spent my career studying stress and its regulation in children and its effects on brain and behavioral development. We like to talk about three levels of stress because stress is not bad. Do not wrap your children in bubble wrap. This is a really lousy way to develop effective citizens. Some stress, normative levels of stress, is positive as children learn that they are able to cope with and deal with life with good supportive care. Some we think of as tolerable. These are things that we would prefer never to happen to kids, to be in a car accident, to have something awful happen. But they are tolerable if they have good serve and return supportive relationships around them. They will likely get through this okay and may even be strengthened because, again, they learn how to access all their coping resources. The thing that we worry about, we've labeled for communication purposes toxic stress, and this is the experience of frequent chronic elevation in stress hormones and other biochemicals that will change the brain and adapt it into a brain that will survive stress but may be limited in other things that it can do. And we know this because we know that these neurochemicals will actually change the brain. So this is data from a rat. You're looking at, because you're not going to do this with a human or a monkey, you're looking at the top is a normal nerve cell. It could be one in the prefrontal cortex, our thinking and reasoning part, or the hippocampus, which is important for laying down memories. These areas are very sensitive to stress. What you're seeing on top is all those beautiful connections, and on the bottom, the loss of them. What they've done to the cell on the bottom is they dumped the stress hormone on it. And in reaction to that, it's actually lost some of its connectivity. If we look actually on those processes, what you're looking there, the little nubs, those little nubs are synapses. The way they connect with others. And what you see on the top, there are lots of them and a lot of capacity to connect with others. And on the bottom, the synapses have been retracted. This is actually the brain trying to protect itself because with too much, the neuron will die. So it's trying to protect itself from this constant stress, excuse me. And what we know for adults is after a period of chronic stress, your thinking is sort of fuzzy. Maybe we've all experienced that. Like you're not cooking, you're going through a divorce, and for some reason you're just not as smart as you were, you know, 6 months earlier. But once everything is done, your brain comes back. It knows where it's supposed to go. The difference with the little kids is the brain is developing during that period of time, and so you have a longer-term impact of this kind of chronic stress. We talked about three regions of the brain. We've mentioned prefrontal cortex, reasoning, planning, executive functions, self-regulation, hippocampus, memory, and the amygdala, which is where we are really good at learning and laying down and processing threat. These three regions are very strongly influenced by chronic experiences of stress and hyperactivation of stress biology. Not by a little bit of stress that's good for you. Do not baby, you know. I always get worried that people then walk away and say, my child cried for 13 minutes yesterday and that's going to damage his brain. And no, that was probably good for your kid's brain. So let's show the long-term effects of this. Why are we not going anywhere? Excuse me, this is frozen. Somehow... we see it. Did it go? Good. Excellent. So one of the group of kids that I study are children adopted from orphanages. Orphanages are places where children are not receiving that serve and return care, and they're also often exposed to pathogens and so on. They activate chronic stress in the kid. But then they get adopted into homes. They go from some of the worst to some of the best in the world. If we could give all kids this massive intervention of homes where parents have the resources they need and wanted to have the children and know a lot about how to respond appropriately to children, it would be terrific. And in fact, the intervention is huge for them too. Many of these kids are doing very well. But when we image these children's brains years after adoption, in this study, We have children born and raised in Minnesota. We have children adopted from orphanages between 4 and 12 months of age, and children adopted between 1 and 5 years of age. What we're looking at is the hippocampus. The hippocampus is critical for memory and learning, and what we're seeing is a dose response. You have two hippocampi, one on the left and one on the right, a function of this early, and this is years and years and years after being in these homes with highly educated parents that are well-resourced. Okay? Long-term effects happening well before 4 years of age. Okay? This is a study where we're looking at fMRI, that's the activity of the brain. We're looking at the amygdala. The amygdala processes threat information, and the more it processes, the more intense it's reacting, the more blood gets sent there. The bold response is a measure, actually, of how much blood is going to different parts of the brain. Your brain needs blood in order to do its job, and that's what's being picked up. What you're seeing is these children have, they come from Child Protective Services. Okay, so these are Child Protective Service kids. This is work of a friend of mine, Mary Dozier. And the children are seeing angry faces, fearful faces, happy faces, and neutral faces. They're just being seen the face. They're just looking. They're coming up. And your amygdala picks up threat. And the most intense cue that there's danger in the environment is something looking terrified. So if you are walking down the street and all of a sudden someone's, you are going to react to that. If you don't, you've got a problem. But what we're seeing here is in the scanner with just little pictures, the kids who are really reacting are the ones who have had these adverse early life experiences, the Child Protective Service kids. Their brains are being shaped to be highly sensitive to threat. And in fact, part of what these experiencers are doing early in life as we set the brain up is it's helping the child have an act-first, think-later brain that's highly sensitive to threat, because in those environments, that's what the child needs to cue to, and the child can't sit there going, gee, that looks like a tiger. Interesting. Or that looks like I'm going to get hit. Interesting. No, they have to react. In fact, they react at such low thresholds. This is part of what's making it challenging in schools, is they kick in defensive responses when it's just an ambiguous stimulus that other kids would ignore. And as a teacher, you're working with them, and they are dealing with danger, and you are dealing with when Columbus crossed the ocean, and it's not working together, right? This is the basis of worrying about trauma-informed care, where teachers begin to understand why they're getting these atypical reactions out of these kids. And finally, this is coming out of Bucharest, Romania, where they were able to randomly assign children to stay in the orphanages or go into foster care, and that was because there was no foster care in Romania at the time that they did this. Now, there's plenty of foster care. It changed their whole system. What you're looking at is brain electrical activity coming off the top of the head. The kids were 8 when they measured the brain electrical activity, and the children were removed from the orphanages and placed in high-quality foster homes either before 2 or after 2 years of age. Again, it's a heat map, and what you're seeing is the brighter red, the more the neurons are actually activated, the more the nerves are sending information. So if you look up there on the top right, those are the kids who stayed in the institutions. And the brain's not very active. The left, those are the kids that were removed after age 2 and placed in families, and they don't look any different than the ones that stayed. Something really critical is happening in those early years. As we go down, the ones on the right are family-reared Romanian kids, and they're thinking, their brains are cooking when they're going through this. They're thinking a lot, and the ones on the left are the ones that were removed and placed in families before age 2. Early matters. All of our neuroscience data is telling, it's not that it's over by the time you're 3 or 4. It's not that we can stop supporting children at that age. It's not that we can't get in and help children. Many of those kids who got out before, after age 2 into those families are doing much better behaviorally than the kids who stayed in the institution. But they need lots of support. They need a much more scaffolding to do as well. Representative Chair Pinto, how much longer do I have?
Well, I want to make sure we have some good time for questions. Let's see what...
I think we're okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We're almost done here. So what I put up here are some of the factors that can crash the capacity for families to provide good serve in return and reduce toxic stress. So these kinds of factors are only some of many, and we all could think of them. You know, if the family's concerned about their physical safety, if they have poor housing and they're likely to be evicted, if they're not sure about their income and they have to work crazy hours, if they don't know whether they've got childcare and their health is of concern and they don't have insurance, these are things that weigh their stresses on families. And we know that these kinds of things can create a risky developmental context. Not for all parents, not for all families. There are parents that are coping with all of these things and still providing amazing context for their kids. I've seen them. Maybe some of you have seen them. I have been in awe of them because if I know if our place has been reversed, I would not be able to do what they're doing at all. I just find them amazing people. But we don't want families to have to be amazing in order to be able to provide. We want the average family to be able to do what's right by their kids. So this is a study, came out of Wisconsin, where they imaged children's brains multiple times over the course of the first 3 years. And they were looking at the total gray matter volume. How many nerve cells does the child have? And they did it as a function of the family's socioeconomic class. Many of those things that crash families are things that we find among people who are struggling with poverty. And what you see is by age 3, the brain volume, what the kid has to work with, is different between those who are in the highest SES and those who are in the lowest SES. This does not mean that brain volume might not increase if, in fact, we know it will a bit, if you get them into stimulation-rich environments, great pre-K for 4-year-olds, right? But you're starting at, you're digging out of a hole already, right? That is the point, that by 3 already, all of these things are there, and we're playing catch up and helping kids do workarounds rather than getting it right the first time.
And Dr. Gunter, just clarifying, SES is socioeconomic status.
Socioeconomic. The lowest group were families trying to raise their kids in poverty.
Thank you.
Just very clearly. So last little bit. Pre to three is a sensitive period for lifelong health. We know that experiences early of toxic stress, environmental exposures to toxins and other things, malnutrition, gets embedded, I've just explained that, in these early years, and it, over time, will increase, it's embedded and creates physiological disruptions, which over time, in interaction with the world, tends to lead to diseases, disorders, health-threatening behavior, and lower educational attainment, and ultimately earlier death. I'm just going to give you one example from my own research. It's actually pretty new, hot off the presses stuff. It's again with children who are adopted from orphanages. And we have recently, these kids in this study are, pretty sure, yeah, we're average of 16 years of age. We have brought them in. We have bled them because by 16, they're more than happy to sell a little bit of their blood to us for a large amount of money, and it's ethical to do that. And we've looked at something called inflammation. One of the things that the field is beginning to understand is that chronic, mild, inflammatory states are the basis for and contribute to cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease, and brain aging. And what you're seeing here is the little blue bars, oh, those are 3 different cytokines, inflammatory measures of the immune system. On the far left, the blue in each of those groupings are children adopted before about 18 months of age, which was the median of our group. So we split at 18, so we had enough in each to look at. The oranges are the ones adopted between 18 months and about 4 years. And then the grays are the kids born and raised in Minnesota. So we are seeing at 16 the effects of chronic inflammation out of the kids that were adopted beyond about a year and a half of age. So whatever they were experiencing in this orphanage has changed their immune system and set them up to move in the direction of chronic inflammatory state, which will potentially threaten their lives if they don't engage even more in exercise, eating right, and all the things. So they're at risk, but they can do things about it. So again, take-home message, and I will be very happy to discuss this all with you. Conception and through those first few years lays down the foundation for brain architecture. Like a house, if the foundation is weak, it threatens what comes afterwards. But you never give up on a kid, okay? It's not over at three at all, but we can get it started the right way. There aren't do-overs, but we can figure out ways around. But the best and most cost-effective thing is to help all of our families and our children get it right from the get-go. So thank you very much. I will, I'm setting the next guys up. This is our evidence also in cost effectiveness, which they will do. And what we know is interventions early have a bigger return on the dollar than interventions later. But that's your next meeting you will have, as I understand.
It'll be coming up. Thank you for the presentation. Member questions. Representative Heitzman.
So I was waiting for the slide that would walk us through the impact of some other interactions, and you're probably going to hear this question often from people, so you don't. All the electronic stimuli that my kids can interact with, where's the slide showing the kid that is completely deprived of the entertainment opportunities and the other ones that are just completely overwhelmed and spending 10 hours a day using social media or video games and things of that sort?
Yeah, that's a great
Dr.
question.
Dr. Gunner.
Yes, Representative Heisman. Absolutely fabulous question. So the reason those games are so seductive is they are serve and return interaction. The kid is doing something, they're getting a response. They're having an effect on the world. We are so oriented towards those kind of interactions because throughout our evolution, they've been the right ones for helping to train us. And now they've been co-opted, right? Everything in moderation is also something for us all to remember. So playing those games somewhat, great, nice. Playing them to the detriment of any one-on-one social relations and so on, very worrisome. But I will remind all of us that with every new technology, the world has come to an end, right? So when television came, it was going to totally destroy us, right? Then when video, and on. So there's concerns, but we might be sort of a little too concerned. But any good developmentalist, any good pediatrician will tell parents to do your absolute best to reduce the amount of screen time and to get your kids out and playing in the world and interacting with people despite all those fights that you have to engage in.
Representative Heisman?
Thank you, Mr. Follow-up? Chair. Just a quick follow-up.
Of course.
I'm assuming there is research that we could find, and I've Googled a little bit and found some, but is there any that you would specifically point to if there has been some good work done on the issue? Because, of course, when kids are told, no, it's not going to be an option today, or maybe there's a limit to that, there's got to be something that you would consider credible to give parents some kind of a guide in terms of what they might expect. And because kids, if you don't have that opportunity, you find something else, and it's astounding the things that they come up with.
Representative Heisman, I have to ask, do your kids respond to peer-reviewed research? Because mine do not. But I guess these would be the dad questions, Dr. Gunner, because I'm wondering about this as well for my kids. Dr.
Yes,
Gunner?
Yes, Representative Heisman and Chair Pinto. The challenge that we always face in research is that the kids who do more of something and the kids who do less, so we can look at the correlation, there's also something different about those kids, right? So we have to find the few studies, very difficult studies, where they've randomly assigned kids to more or less screen time. Typically, that would mean reducing screen time. There are some out there, and they're nice studies, but it's really hard to find them. You're going to find many, many, many more correlational studies, all of which say these kids are going to be different than other kids. We ran through this whole gamut when it was television and viewing violence, and the kids who viewed more violence TV were more violent themselves. But where was the chicken and where was the egg? You know, the kids that liked it also were prone in that direction. The end result of all of that, I am guessing, is going to be similar to this one, which is what you're prone to attracts you strongly, and if you engage in it, you develop those brain circuits more. So that it's a dynamic, and if I were a parent right now, my kids are older, they're having my grandchildren now, I would limit screen time as much as I could, and I'd limit it from the get-go so that they were used to that. And then it's the balance of where are your kids, they're always over at the Smith's house because there they get to do all the stuff you don't let them do. And so you're back and forth. But you're still limiting it. You're not letting it go overboard. And they know your values. And it's not just you can't do something. Here's what we want you doing instead, and this is why this is good and better and fun to do.
Okay, it sounds like we probably would appreciate if you did have any follow-up you could send us, though.
I will go looking for you.
Okay, good.
Good to see you.
Okay. Anything? No. And so Representative Pryor, I think, was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, and I don't have, again, I can't point to the research, but from time to time I read studies that are animal studies about how something that happens to one generation actually still has impacts on on the next generations too. Do we, and mostly when I read them, they've been actually the prenatal before birth, but are there studies now that talk about experiences in one generation still having impacts on future generations?
Dr. Gunner.
Representative Pryor and Chair Pinto. Okay, this is the freaky part of epigenetics, which is that Lamarck lives. He was the one I thought anything you did was going to get carried on. And there is some evidence. The best evidence is in animals. It's relatively narrow to the kinds of experiences. Some of it's postnatal, but you know, if you're studying little rodents, their first few weeks of life is like our third trimester, so they're still pretty, so it's probably a prenatal thing for us. The strongest evidence that we have actually is in the area of famine, right? So famine, terrible famine, influencing prenatal development and the fetus, and we know some of these things. And then it seems to jump a generation. This is work out of the Nordic countries, where your grandpa's famine is showing up in your birth rate. But it's still, I get very, very concerned when we start talking about intergenerational trauma as being an example of epigenetic transition across generations. And the reason I get concerned is I don't know that we have to go there. There are plenty of reasons why trauma in one generation that influences the parents then can get carried on and so on. Many, many pathways, but there's a lot of excitement about being able to say, oh, that's carried on in your molecules. I don't think we really know that yet.
Okay. Representative Morrison.
Chair Pinto, Dr. Gunner, thank you for a fascinating presentation with so much great information in it. Bringing the screens back to early childhood, I believe the American Academy of Pediatricians recommends no screens prior to age 2.
That's a good, good recommendation.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Just a point of clarification on that early study that you cited about mother-reared versus peer-reared monkeys, I think?
Rhesus monkeys.
The point of that is to demonstrate that experience impacts genes. We can't extrapolate from that study that babies must be raised by their biological mother.
Dr. Gunner.
Thank you very much, Representative
Morrison
and Chair Pinto. Yes. It is really difficult. Well, that's not entirely true. In most animal species, it's hard to get the dads to be the parents. Okay. In some animal species, the dad is the one that does most of this. So you end up saying mothers, but it's whoever is serving the function of mothering. It could be dad, it could be mom, it could be grandma, it could be grandpa, it could be an aunt and an uncle. It doesn't matter, right? As long as that care is being received.
Dr. Gunner, if you can, I don't see any current hands. If you can go back to the slide a few back where it seemed to imply to me the discussion about ACEs, but I don't think that you referenced adverse childhood experiences specifically. I may have missed that. If not, it seems like a critical enough topic that I just wanted to ask you.
Sure. Tell me where.
That was the one. There you go.
Right here?
Yeah.
Okay. ACEs. Adverse childhood experiences. The way you measure those, this was figured out by folks with the CDC and Kaiser Permanente, and they were taking adults who had medical care through Kaiser Permanente and having them fill out information about their their experiences prior to age 18. There were 10 of those items that has now become reified into things that we are using in many communities. And yes, many of us have at least one or two adverse experiences in our childhood, but it isn't until you get to many more that you start seeing effects, associations. Here's where a developmentalist has a heart attack with ACEs. It's retrospective reporting.
And Dr. Gunn, I may remind you, folks on the committee may not know what ACEs are, so you may need to talk
adverse childhood experience.
Okay. Yeah. So I may not have heard that term. Thank you.
Yes. So the 10 items include things like your parents got divorced, somebody in your family had trouble with substance abuse, you experienced a death of a parent, you were physically maltreated, sexually maltreated, so those kinds of things, right? So the reason we have a heart attack is it's retrospective reporting. Now, it turns out that your mood affects what you remember about your early life. And this even happens over a week. So for example, if you have people fill out a checklist of what they did across the week, and then at the end of the week, have them remember. If they're in a happy mood, they remember all the great stuff. And if they're in a sad mood, they remember more of the negative stuff. There have now been studies done that were prospective, so you followed them over the course of their life, studies. And then when they were adults, you had them complete the ACEs. And the only thing that tends to be stable is whether your parent died. Okay. The correlation is 0.3. You explain 9% of the variance. Now, and the ones who remember more negative stuff are the more neurotic ones who tend to get sick more, and the ones who remember more positive stuff are the ones who see the world as being a fabulous place, and they tend to be healthy anyway. On the other hand, so that would like deep six, all ACEs work. The prospective studies are also the ones showing most powerfully the influence of early experiences on health. It's just it's hard to get there from what people remember. Is that okay? So the story is probably true. We probably are not getting our best information by asking for retrospective reports. But the problem with people is they grow up at the same rate as researchers. And so it's very, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to have to wait for, 60 years. So we're putting together the prospective work. The Institute of Child Development is known for its prospective longitudinal studies, and many of the kids we've been following throughout the state are getting into their 40s and 50s, and we are really looking at the health impacts now, and we have the data on what they experience.
So, Dr. Gunner, I guess when I saw this slide, I thought that this was simply a restatement of the ACEs work, but it sounds like that's not quite right.
It's much deeper. It's got all the other work in there. It's based partly on ACEs, but much, much more on many other studies that are more prospective.
And then could you also go back to the slide, I think maybe one or two prior to this, that shows the brain volume up to age 3?
Yeah.
Because I feel like there are a couple of points.
Sure, happy to do it. Wait a minute, I'm going forward.
It feels like the other way around.
There. Yep.
There was. So first, is it correct to assume that at least simplistically speaking, more brain volume is better. It's going to give the child a better opportunity for success in life, just looking at that simplistically when we look at this slide.
At the level of this slide, yeah, probably.
Okay. And then can you talk about, and I feel like this implicates so much of your presentation, and I'm seeing each of the pieces kind of linking with one another. What is it that drives that then, that those children growing up in poverty are at this big disadvantage? I think that there's a lot of debate or discussion about how much of a person's circumstances are driven by simply their own choices, or in a child's case, by the actions individually of parents, sort of driven by those parents alone, versus the broader factors. And yeah, it does seem like this connects to that. Can you kind of, it seems like a number of the points that you made link together in that to help us understand why it is that the kids get on those different trajectories?
Ultimately, ultimately what's connecting with the kids are their direct experiences, and those are going to be carried largely by the people they're being cared by, okay? And the things that we think are the sort of the key ingredients are serve and return care and the experience of toxic stress, okay? So we think those are the key, and I showed you in the slide earlier where Joan Luby was assessing both of those and seeing that related. Now, the issue is, the issue of choice and the issue of what can we legislate, right? We can't legislate that parents do good serve and return care, right? We can't legislate certain things, but we can do things that might be able to alter the likelihood that they'll find it very difficult to do that kind of care. I will say that the best way we know of in animals to destroy parenting, caring for their babies, is to make a poverty condition for an animal. So in little rats, the way you do that, a rat mommy likes to make her nest. And she, when she's getting ready to deliver, she creates this nice little nest, and then she delivers, and she puts her pups in the nest, and she licks them and grooms them, and she feeds them, and all is good. If you only give her one paper towel to make her nest never gets to look very good, and she never quite settles into her routine, and she's sort of frantically running around trying to find more nesting material or deal with the basics. So reducing, you know, making housing challenging for that mommy rat doesn't let her do her thing. With monkeys, they don't build a nest, so you don't do that. What you make is food unpredictable. So you create a wall where you stick your hand in, and you can get a little piece of food, and it's got a lot of holes. And sometimes it's very predictable where the food's going to be. Sometimes you can make it very unpredictable, and they might not manage to get enough food. That destroys their parenting. In fact, they almost get rid of their, if you give them a chance to get rid of their babies, they put them on another side of a wall. It's sort of like, you go over there, I got to worry about this food thing and my relations with the other females that we're all fighting over this food. So those kinds of things really damage animal parenting, and we know they damage human parenting as well. Not, again, that parents can't manage to be really great parents in the context of that kind of strife, but we're human, and most of us are weak, and those are also conditions where we might seek ways of dealing with our own stress, which all can have terrible ramifications, drugs, alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, families with support do better. It does take a state, in some sense, a village, a church, a synagogue, you know, all of these supports around families. And again, I sure know this because I've been running to grocery stores for the first few months of my grandchild's life, picking up food to take to the poor parents who weren't getting any sleep and thinking about, oh my gosh, aren't they lucky that there's two of them and that there are all these grandparents running around going grocery shopping for them? And what if there was just one and no other support? So.
Thank you. Other questions for the testifier, if folks have. I don't see any. This has been incredibly helpful. I guess maybe Dr. Gunner, could you just a couple more? If you could go to that next slides. You said this is a bit setting up the preview for intervention.
Yeah, I'll get it. Finish it up. Okay.
Yeah.
So we know that getting it right the first time is probably both biologically and from society cheaper. And what we know from the studies of intervention, and this is Heckman, who is a Nobel laureate, is Art Rolnick and his folks at the Federal Reserve, who repeated this, that the return on investment tends to be higher if we invest in those early years and get it right the first time. Again, it's not to say don't invest in the later years. That's crazy, right? But our biggest return on investment is doing investments in the early years that really get serve and return doing well for the kid and reduce the kid's experience of toxic stress. We can manage that. Those investments can return anywhere from 9 to 16 on the dollar. But they're not cheap. That's the other thing that all of this work has shown us, is that to do it, you need to do it right. And oftentimes we have an invention that works great, and then we try to do it on the cheap, and quite frankly, you're just throwing money away at some point. And I know that's what all the finance folks try to figure out, is where do we get this, where's the sweet spot? Where do we get the best return on our investments? And just finally, guys, if you want more information, there's ICD-UMN-EDU. But you can also, I'm part of this National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, which is a group of us scientists from across the country that come together to try to make sure that we've got the science right, and then we work with communication experts to try to get it translated into a way that will make sense to legislators, and there is just loads of stuff. So if you Google National Scientific Council. There's loads of stuff. And I've brought some things. You've got some of the in-briefs there from us. And there are working papers that are like 5 pages long, so they're more in-depth, that I gave to Representative, to Chair Pinto, that you would have access to, or just go. There are videos. There's all sorts of stuff on that website.
And I do want to direct the attention of your members, but also audience members as well. We had the physical handouts, but then I believe they're on the website as well for those who are watching via webcast. Some really helpful handouts on brain development and child development. That's really good. Thank you very much, Dr.
Thank
Gunner.
You
this
very
has been
much.
Really, really helpful. We have just a few items of kind of closure, members. It'll take just a couple minutes. Representative Bonner, we earlier did introductions, just your district and your interest in this area, your connection with this issue. So please share that. Representative Bonner.
Is this live?
Yeah, sounds like it is.
Okay. My name is Kristen Bonner. I am from Representative, from District 34B, which is Maple Grove and Osseo.
And any particular connection or interest with this work that you want to share? Representative Bonner?
You know, I think, I won't go into too much detail, but I can tell you that I come to the early childhood development as a child who, you know, both my parents were young childhood sweethearts, and they worked hard and worked night shifts. I spent a lot of times in my formative years with my grandmother, and I think about how I got a very good start in life. We literally lived in a trailer until I was 3. And of course now a graduate of Gustavus and here at the legislature, but I think about how my experience could have been vastly different if I hadn't gotten the support in those early childhood years that I did. And I think very long and hard about families who may not have those opportunities. And so that is particularly why I'm interested in early childhood development.
That's great. Thank you. And members, I'll be contacting each of your offices to get together, try to set up a one-on-one conversation just to find out more about your interests in particular areas you'd like to focus on in the committee. One important housekeeping issue, there is going to be no meeting a week from today. So members of the audience and then members of the committee and staff, no meeting a week from today. So if you've got your 3-day weekend going, you can extend that just a little bit, and then we'll continue from there. And then on Thursday, we're going to start diving into presentations from state agencies, and we're organizing them by topic area as much as we can. So on Thursday, we're going to build on this presentation to talk about prenatal care and birth, and from the Department of Health and Department of Human Services on those topics. I think that's all. I think that's all. And so with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thanks very much.